Hi, it's Tierney. You're about to hear me talk to Molly Lambert, a writer from Los Angeles and Valley Girl icon. You can read Molly's work in magazines like Elle, In Style, The New York Times Magazine, and The New Yorker. She also authored the introduction to the newest collection of Eve Babbitt's essays, I Used to Be Charming, The Rest of Eve Babbitt's, and is one of the hosts of Night Call Podcast, with new episodes dropping every Monday. I'm going to read you a little bit of Molly's introduction to the Eve Babbitt's collection. So these are Molly Lambert's words. I was nervous to read the title essay to this collection, Babbitt's first sustained writing about the 1997 accident that largely put an end to her writing career, because I worried about what it would do to the intertwined mythoi of Babbitt's and L.A. Time and time again in her work, Babbitt's had crushed the notion that women were objects rather than subjects. She simply effortlessly embodied both roles. Despite being a writer myself and knowing full well that writing is an act of prolonged seduction that involves portraying oneself as maybe a little bit funnier, sexier, and more self-aware than the reality, I was afraid to discover that there was a sadder, more vulnerable soul inside the confident public Babbitt's. Could she, just like me, have been projecting a fearlessness in her writing that isn't fully representative of who she really is? The answer, of course, is yes. Of course, she is vulnerable and human and cognizant of her own brashness, and so am I. And it's not only fine, it's wonderful. My friends would kill me if I died, is what Babbitt says about her accident, joking, but telling the truth. To be a female artist is to put your own stubborn obsessions above all else in a world that still expects you to take care of other people while setting your own obsessive interests aside. Throughout her life, Babbitt's moved among stubborn, creative men who did exactly as they pleased, who did only exactly as they pleased, and she did the same in her own way, to a more radical effect. To be impulsive is to be accident-prone. To follow your passions is to risk letting them consume you. And women with great appetites for life are often demonized for their desires, just as men are lionized for theirs. Again, that was some of Molly Lambert's introduction to I Used to Be Charming, The Rest of Eve Babbitt's. Check out the book. It's tons of individual pieces from Eve Babbitt's and, of course, Molly. And I hope you enjoy this conversation. Tierney Finster, Molly Lambert, 818 Baby. Welcome to the first episode of Tierney Talks, recorded from my bedroom, more specifically my bed. I'm so happy to be here Skyping with Molly Lambert.
Hi.
Yay. Are you, you're at home right now, or are you in the car?
I'm at home. I'm on the couch.
Nice. And do you live on like, Highland Park or Pasadena? Or?
Yeah, I live in like the borderland of Mount Washington and Highland Park. Like technically Mount Washington, but nice. I call it Highland Park.
Yeah. My aunt, my mom's oldest sister lives in Mount Washington, and growing up in the valley, I thought she lived like so far away.
No, I totally think of places I thought were like so far away from the valley. Dodger Stadium also, I like have no idea where that was.
Like we got to stop and get a sandwich, you know, like in the whole outing because it's so far away.
Right. It's like a wagon trail.
I know. I think about that like, when I think about like growing up in the valley creatively, what I'm really interested in like telling certain stories about is how you can be so insider outsider. Like you have this like experience coming into LA and like getting your sense of geography as if you moved from like far away.
Yeah.
You could have been spending your whole time there too.
It's a little bit like New Jersey is my feeling.
Right.
It's like you're so close.
Just close enough. Yeah. If you're real determined, you'll be able to just take the red line to Hollywood. That's what I did. So obviously we've been all socially distanced at home. I wanted to tell you that your power as a cultural selector is so strong because all you had to do was tweet about Lacey Peterson, and I wasn't even sure if I was watching the same documentary as you were, but like ever since I read you mention the name, I was like, I would really like to know more about her right now.
Yeah, it's weird how things are so weird now that in a way true crime feels like escapism.
Yes.
Things that a few months ago I might have been like, this is too dark and depressing. Now I'm like, well, you know, who can even like get close enough to someone to murder them right now?
Right. Like we're safe in that regard. I feel you because I think when I started it, it was probably Monday or Tuesday this week. And it only took me like one evening and then a quick morning follow-up session to finish. And basically when I turned to the series, I was in probably one of my worst moods. I would say funky moods as a synonym for depressed, I guess. Just like feeling... I was totally feeling bad and then turned to Lacey to like fully disengage from this reality.
Yeah, it's just very absorbing. I didn't really know anything about that case other than that I had watched Gone Girl, which is based on it kind of in a fantasy way. Yeah. But I didn't realize it was in the 2000s. I think I just assumed it was in the 90s because all the big true crime stories are from the 90s. So I think I was probably in college when it happened. So I definitely just wasn't watching cable news enough to be up on something like that.
Yeah. But
it's totally fascinating. And the documentary that I watched was called The Murder of Lacey Peterson.
Is that the one you watched? It's just six-parter, right?
Yeah, but there's like two on Hulu. There's like two.
So interesting.
Multi-part documentaries. But yeah. The thing I thought was so interesting about it is that it takes place in Modesto. And so there's all this stuff also about Modesto and how it's like supposed to be this, you know, perfect California exurb, but it's got all this darkness.
That was the craziest part of the documentary to me. Like I was kind of like waiting for the dark cloud of Modesto to surface like factually because the one I watched, they're like setting it up to be this Americana kind of like place. I'm like, Modesto is not, they're like, Modesto's not to say it's not a great place to live, you know, but I think I just have some cousins in Merced where I was like, no one is like going all out for Modesto, you know?
Yeah, well, there's a part where they show the logo of the town and it's like water wealth something and health, and then later this guy is like, oh yeah, my students all called it like murder, meth, and auto theft.
It's so good. I didn't know. I read tabloids like super intensely around 2000. I think the case is 2001, 2002, and then all the way through like 2005. And I remember I was just too scared of the themes to engage. Like,
yeah.
I was kind of annoyed, you know?
No, I mean, I remember, you know, I feel like Gone Girl sort of made me more aware of it, where I was just like, oh, right, this guy, it was the perfect marriage, he killed his wife, but then this documentary made me, you know, I still think he probably did kill her, was what I came away from this thinking, but this documentary is really good because it just shows how the cops really fucked up the police work, and the trial was totally fucked up.
It was horrible. I mean, it basically goes through so many. Basically, they were just obsessed with the Scott storyline. And there were so many, like, different viable pieces of evidence that were, like, offered. They weren't even found. Like, people were calling in with evidence that was just never, like, followed up on.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of these true crime documentaries, really, that's what they're about, is about how the system is like set up to make these people guilty, whether they are or not, because that is what people want.
Right.
And in this case, it was like, well, also there was all this true crime television and people like Nancy Grace on TV, like talking about Scott Peterson. and saying stuff that was actually just false about the case, but saying it so much and really just vilifying him so much that people were just like thirsty for his head on a platter.
Yeah.
Whether he had done it or not, like they didn't care.
Right. Which is understandable, I guess, if you think about all the like, I mean, you see those women like gathering outside the courthouse and celebrating.
That part's crazy.
Yeah. I guess it's like, part of me was like, okay, I see how so much crime, especially crime against women, goes like nobody gets justice. Of course, that's not that I think the death penalty is justice, because I don't anyway, but like, it's just crazy to see the like hordes cheering for it, and that they said it was more popular like in the actual trial space, that there was more people there than the Michael Jackson trials.
Yeah, it's just like the tabloidification of it. Yeah, it's also similar to the OJ trial, where it's like the actual details of the case, sort of like the cultural imagination of the case, like just runs away from it into this other place that's about just like broader issues, like, you know, racial justice and the police in LA. But in this case, it didn't feel like these were like women who were passionate about domestic violence cases. It just felt like they were like women who watch too much TV and
Nancy Grace fans.
Yeah, it made me really be like, Nancy Grace is bad, y'all. Like,
I know, right?
She doesn't care. And there's a part at the end where they're like, well, how do you, you know, what do you think about like knowing these details? Like, she just doesn't claim any culpability for it. She's like, well, I just do what I had to do, and that's my job. And, you know, he was a bad man, and now he's going to die.
Even during it, they keep being like, Nancy, you're a prosecutor. Like, you're not speaking, like, the way you're talking about this isn't making sense as a prosecutor. And she's like, well, I'm not in court right now. I'm not on TV right now. Yeah,
I'm on television. Like, yeah, and the doc did a really smart thing also, which was to sort of juxtapose those clips of Nancy Grace and other tabloid journalists just, like, saying stuff that was blatantly false about the case because it was, like, exciting and good TV.
Yeah.
With George W. Bush lying us into the Iraq War.
Right.
It like makes this very clear parallel of like, okay, here's the moment where we crossed over into like what makes good TV, just completely overriding what actually is happening.
Yeah.
Which feels like the world that we live in now, like extremely to me.
Totally. Like they make a point of just feeding the 24-hour news cycle and like, there's someone in the doc is like, if you want like expert, I don't know the quote, but they're like, if you want expert reporting, you wouldn't be sharing that reporting 24/7, you know?
Right. And like they, you know, as in Gone Girl, the fact is that Scott Peterson was definitely cheating on his wife. And they sort of use that to be like, oh, well, a man who would like lie to his wife about having sex with somebody else, you know, is capable of anything. But it just seems possible that maybe he was cheating on his wife, but not planning to kill her, although they don't obviously make a great case. I mean, they're sort of like, maybe these robbers did it.
Yeah.
It still kind of ends with like Scott is the main suspect, you know,
right.
But when they go through the trial, you're just like, this should have been a hung jury for sure. Like there's definitely reasonable doubt if you actually listen to the facts of the case. Like they can't prove it and there's no body. So like, you know, and then there was a body, but like they still, I don't know.
Yeah.
It just raised a lot of reasonable doubt for me where I was
definitely,
like, you know, if I were a juror on this case, I would not be able to like fully in my conscience say that he did it 100%. And there's even a juror who says that and they get rid of them.
I was going to say the foreman basically, who's like, supposed to be the kind of, he's just not letting it move along too quickly, and he's wanting to go through it really objectively because he's like a lawyer and a doctor or something crazy, and they're like, we need him out.
Yeah, and they replace him with somebody who's like a fan of the case.
Oh, strawberry shortcake.
Strawberry shortcake.
Oh, she's the true winner. Like basically this juror gets added to the case and the press at least that are like the local press camped out there refer to her as Strawberry Shortcake because she has like bright pink hair. But even in the earlier episodes before she's introduced, like they showed some court footage with her in it, and I was just like, who is this character? I need her. So no, I was really relieved.
She has amazing style, but she's definitely evil. She's evil. It's like she wants to be the person who puts Scott Peterson away, which is like, should disqualify you from being on the jury for that case. But they were like, no, that's perfect. Let's replace the person who has reasonable doubts about this with someone who just thinks he's guilty so we can like put him away and then, you know, put it on TV. And like,
who had lied about ever being involved in a court case before. Turns out she had like submitted some kind of like petition for her own safety while pregnant. So like when you're seeing her give this emotionally fueled like speech after the sentence is made public or the verdict's made public, she's like straight up calling Scott Peterson an asshole after they're like sentencing him to death. It's like,
right. And again, it's like, it just becomes about something else. It's just about the fact that like people don't get justice for the most part for domestic violence and for, you know, women getting killed in domestic violence incidents. And it's just like, they're like, he just becomes like the symbol of that, where they're just like, okay, we can't put them all away, but we can put this one guy away. But right. It just completely overrides how the justice system is supposed to work.
Yeah. Like I also just thought it was interesting since I haven't watched a ton of true crime stuff. Like, I'm still just really entertained that, like, they have all the real police calls and just the access that these, like, documentarians get.
Yeah, and I really like, there's, like, the woman who is reporting the story from the beginning locally, and she seems sort of, like, on the level. Like, that's what's funny is it's, like, there's some real journalists at the beginning, and it's a local story at the beginning. It's, like, a Modesto story.
Yeah.
And then people, it just gets picked up by cable news and it just turns into this other thing. And like, in part, it's because Scott Peterson is like this handsome dude who looks exactly like Ben Affleck.
That's what I was just gonna say. Like, I was watching it with I'm forgetting this new word for like the person you have sex with that you're quarantined with at home, but whatever, my domestic partner, we watched it together and he has never seen Gone Girl. And I was like, oh, I have a treat for you because the Ben Affleck parallelism is just too real.
Yeah. And there's some like specific moments that are in Gone Girl. And also the book Gone Girl, if you haven't read it by Gillian Flynn, super recommend it as a quarantine read. It's like a great page turner. But yeah, he also kind of looks like Dean Cain. He's played by Dean Cain, I think, in another
actually really good too. Yeah.
There's like this big moment in the book and the movie where he's at the vigil for his missing wife. And he's like giving the speech about how they need to find her. And then like right after he gives the speech, he like does this little weird shitbag smile. And that's the photo they run everywhere. Yeah. Is like the picture of him smiling. And that is totally what happened with Scott Peterson. I didn't know that was like specifically from the case. It's like, they get a photo of him like laughing with somebody at the vigil and then they run it everywhere. Like, heartless Scott Peterson laughing it up while his wife is missing. He doesn't care.
Which and it seems crazy. But then it seems like the press is being the crazy party in that case. But then you find out like the real moment that's based on with Scott Peterson. He was like at the vigil for Lacey and Modesto with all the family on like New Year's Eve. And then he's calling his girlfriend Amber Fry being like, Normandy was nuts. I'm in Paris. Like,
I mean, that is a crazy moment when he's like, I'm in Paris. I can see the fireworks.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. It's like he might be a shitty guy, but like, does that make him a murderer?
He's a murderer? I really don't think it does. Like, I never thought I was going to be in a position to really give a fuck to not defend Scott Peterson, but
I know.
Think it's like,
it's just
I really wouldn't be like, oh, I think he for sure did it. Like, I don't.
Yeah, actually... you're just defending the reasonable doubt. And when they just get into, like, oh, there's all these witnesses that the cops didn't listen to, and they get those witnesses in the documentary to be like, oh, I saw her jogging on that day. Like, she definitely made it all the way home. Right. You know, the one thing that does point to Scott Peterson's guilt is, like, why was the body in the San Francisco Bay?
Right.
But then they do this, like, experiment to, like, prove that it would have been hard for him to get the body out of the boat.
In the that part. The
defense claims they did.
That's like, the glove moment. For
yeah. But I came out of this documentary, like, what do I know about anything? Who
right.
Who can say? But at least thinking, that the justice system is bad and fucked up right now.
Yeah, it just made me scared for anything to happen to anybody. Because, like,
yeah,
it doesn't mean shit. And I felt really uncomfortable with, like, how it made me feel about juries. Like, obviously, yeah. I support a free and fair trial for everyone. It's just, like, the way that jury functioned was, I mean, I know we can't talk about Scott Peterson this whole time, but, like, the idea that one of the jurors during this extremely high-profile trial was going to a bar, getting drunk, and bragging about the book deal he was going to get after this.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it definitely condemns sort of like the tabloid trial as an institution that now exists. But yeah, it's just a fascinating documentary.
Thank you for putting me on.
For sure. It's also, yeah, it's funny to like go back to the era of 9/11 and the Iraq War and be like, oh, this feels less stressful than now, which it, you know, that's didn't wild, at the time. Right? Yeah.
Totally.
Have you done Tiger King yet?
Oh, yeah. I plowed through that one. And I actually really want to listen to your podcast Night Call, do a full round table or like crosstalk on it. But what was that experience like? Like, what was your take?
We had different opinions at Night Call because Emily Yoshida really didn't like it. Me and Tess Lynch both did. Emily sort of thought the like exploitation of the people involved like made her uncomfortable. Just sort of the like bad people just being on camera in that way. I did not have that problem with it. I thought it was amazing and just very absorbing and, you know, I didn't feel like it treated these people condescendingly, which is what made it work for me.
I didn't think that either. And I definitely, I mean, as are you, but just like, I'm definitely not into like mocking the working class or whatever.
Yeah, totally. I was like, people are just interesting as like the, you know, even though it was fucked up in every possible way, the fact that they built like sort of a queer family unit in the middle of like,
yeah,
the just total red state country where it was just like this libertarian thing of like, yeah, you can do whatever you want. This is America. Like you can own tigers. You can marry two guys. You can
get your dick pierced, get a tiger.
Yeah. And just that everyone around Joe Exotic and these other people, I don't know. I mean, it kind of reminded me, I was saying, of Finding Neverland, the documentary, because it is also like they use the big cats as a lure to get people into their world. And it just works so unbelievably well. Like everybody wants to hold a baby tiger.
Yeah, that part is like, that was one of the most interesting takeaways is just how like the presence of these animals translated into so many different like power, like just power and intrigue and like attraction.
Yeah. And like I read actually that the alligators that, spoiler alert, get killed when Joe Exotic probably lights the shed on fire himself.
Yeah.
They were all from Neverland originally.
No way.
And the monkeys at the end of the documentary, there's this part, really affecting part about the monkeys who have been kept in cages their whole life. And then they get to go to the Great Ape Preserve and they hug for the first time. It's like this beautiful
so
moment.
So nice.
You know, when Joe Exotic is like, oh, did I fuck up keeping these animals in cages? But that Great Ape Sanctuary is also where Bubbles, the chimp, went to.
Aww.
And Bubbles apparently has like a beautiful life now there where he paints pictures. Isn't that
That's
nice?
So nice.
Yeah.
That's definitely the best thing I've heard about all of the Joe Exotic, like.
well, I think it privileges the animals. I think it's like the animals are obviously getting fucked over, but then it's like, maybe, you know, I didn't see it coming. I wasn't like, oh, this is so on the nose. But when they get to the part where it's like Joe Exotic's in a cage, he doesn't like it. Nobody wants to be in a cage, including humans. You know, it makes the point very, very affectingly. And it is also like we shouldn't have prisons either. So
literally.
No zoos, no prisons, no zoos.
No zoos, no prisons, endorsed for sure. And like, how, I don't know, I think that it's really nice when people are able to make things that have such a, like, the clear takeaway is that these animals have been fucked and that there's so many, like, fucked practices around these, like, animal organizations, but that I like that it caters to the larger story and that by doing that, it also creates this really effective appeal to like the politics or whatever of it, because if it was just like a PETA documentary, not everybody would have watched it.
Right. Well, it also kind of digs into PETA a little bit, which is good because they're not great either. You know, it does sort of say like animal rights organizations are also super fucked up. And also it's true that like there are a lot of animal rights people that like don't give a fuck about human beings, you know.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of like racist animal rights people, like Brigitte Bardot is the one I always mention, who are like, oh, the poor animals, and then like is super racist about Muslims. Like,
totally. It's like really annoying.
It's like they see more humanity in animals than in like actual humans, which is like also insane and bad.
What about, I was really thinking of you when Comrade Brittany emerged last week.
Oh my God, Comrade Brittany. I was thinking of you also. Brittany posted something on her Instagram that was a repost of, I want to look up the name of the girl who wrote it.
Mimi Ju, maybe?
Yeah, Mimi Ju. I believe you're correct. And it's like just a nice post about how we all have to be there for each other and create a new world. And then it also says, and redistribute the wealth and go on strikes. And so everybody was like, Comrade Brittany. And then people were like, okay, well, she didn't actually write this. This artist wrote it, Mimi Ju, and Brittany reposted it. But the fact that Brittany reposted it is amazing.
Yeah.
And to me, that said, you know, something I've always wondered about is like, does Brittany run her own Instagram, or are her handlers like doing it for her?
Right.
Because it's like so weird and quirky that I like do feel like it's her sometimes, you know, but other times I'm like, I don't know. Are they making her like post these yoga videos? But this made me think it was her, because I was like, her handlers wouldn't let her publish something that said redistribute wealth.
Like, hell no. They just literally wouldn't. That was such insightful commentary to glean from this post that was already so amazing in itself. I feel like there was a moment right as her Instagram got like a lot of notable attention, I think is when it got into her own hands. But I too never had a for sure answer.
Yeah, I mean, some of the things, like the posting multiple photos, which she does a lot, like those also seem like, again, I was like, is she doing that? Or like, are her people doing that to make her seem unstable so that they can, to be like, this is why she needs to be under the conservatorship still. Like, you know, look, she's so like off the wall. But she also just posts like things you would think Brittany would post, like a lot of beautiful pictures of flowers.
Roses. And,
like kind of nice like memes of like the moonlit sky, just like, you know, pretty cute Brittany things.
She can't help it, she's girly.
Yeah. But this, you know, I was saying, like, also, she is one of the only celebrities who had a good response to this crisis. She and Rihanna are, like, the only good ones because they just, like, gave money and offered to give money. You know, they weren't like,
yeah,
let me sing a song to lift your spirits. Like, like Rihanna just gave, like, $5 million, which is, like, more
amazing
than, like, you know, Zuckerberg and Bezos are giving, I feel like.
Ridiculous.
And Britney on was just like, hey, if you're having money problems, if you need to, like, give your kid diapers, like, DM me and I'll pay for it, which is, like, incredible. And also just, like, not what most celebrities would do. Like, most celebrities would, like, donate it to some charity. And the fact that Britney was, like, direct action, like, right, I've got all this money, I can't even spend it because I'm, like, trapped in my house. Like, how can I help struggling moms, like, pay for shit during this time? That, to me, like, that is Comrade Britney.
Yeah, like, it was paired with literally, like, her not only posting this but taking positive action.
Yeah.
What do you think, like, for people who maybe haven't been as interested in the nitty-gritty of Britney's life experience as I know we both have and many of our friends, I'm wondering, like, when you talk about Britney not, like, leaving the house and, like, isn't it true, like, Britney's basically, like, she's been used to social distancing or, like, having to be home?
Yeah, totally. She's a social distancing influencer because... Like,
why is that?
Well, I think it's, like, she's not allowed to drive is what I have heard. Is that...
Okay.
After the 2000s when she was, like, driving everywhere...
Everywhere.
That's, like, one of the things, I think, in the conservatorship is she can't drive. So there was, like, a picture not that long ago where she was driving to get fast food and people were like, I don't know if the terms have changed or if she's, like, breaking the rule.
Breaking it, yeah.
Or if we just don't know actually what the terms are and this is all speculation, which is also possible.
True. Because it seemed like it was ending, but it hasn't still.
Well, there's supposed to be a court case. I mean, you know how it is. It's like they want the conservatorship to continue because then they can keep making money off the Britney brand. If it's over, then she can just, you know, retire, essentially, which we would all love for her to do because I think that's what she does want to do. You know, that's why I thought The Zone was fine because I was like, if they want to, like, use her likeness to make money off of her, that is fine.
It's better than making her do work she doesn't want to do.
Yeah, but, like, she's the tiger, man. You know, there was also that picture of her doing the I'm a Slave for You performance where everybody was like, oh, shit, the tiger in that performance that everyone forgot about because the snake was the star.
Oh, yeah, it's from Doc Antle.
It's from Doc Antle. There's a picture of her with Doc Antle. But, you know, yeah, she's the baby tiger, like... She can't be caged. It's sad.
Hell no. She's the ferocious one.
Yeah, and she's the person where you're like, even if you do have this big mansion and, like, this palatial grounds and, like, you have, you know, because we're seeing celebrities, like, all go up against the limits of that. It's like they have these huge houses and you can see that in their videos, but they're also bored just like everybody else. They're like, feel trapped and confined even with all that space. But yeah, Britney has so much experience with that.
She makes the best of it. No wonder she likes working out so much.
I know. She really does make the best of it.
And I mean, her rebelling, I mean, I feel like she's been having her own personal labor rebellion. So that also fits into the Comrade Britney.
Yeah. Belief. Well, she's like Elvis Presley in so many ways. And, like, you know, also in that she, like, yeah, she's like a working class Southerner. And there, you know, are a few directions that can lead you in. And one of them is to be, like, a racist, bad person, you know. But also, like, Elvis and Britney, it seems, like, they just, like, they never forget that they were working class, you know. And they don't become racist because of it. They're just, like, sympathetic to anyone.
Right. Also, I think they're famous enough to feel confident to do that. Like,
yeah,
unfortunately, people are just, like, so desperate to attain something, you know? They're like, yeah, icons.
And they both were like trapped in this prison of their own fame at a certain point where you're like too famous to live your normal life. Because Britney's tragedy is like, she does just want to go to the Coffee Bean and Target and stuff like any other Valley girl.
Any other Calabasas / Tarzana mother.
Yeah, she's such a West Valley mom. She just wants to go to soccer practice. But yeah. She can't even do those like normal person things. And I don't, you know, it seems like she doesn't get to see her sons very much. It seems like Kevin has most of the custody.
That's really weird to me.
Yeah, and then there was that thing where one of her kids like posted an Instagram live or something where they were being a lot like what you would think a little Kevin Federline would be like, just using a lot of gay slurs and saying something about like, you know, my mom makes a lot of money. Where it was like,
oh my,
it was sad. It was really sad because I was like, oh, like Britney's kids.
Well, the West Valley is very Kevin Federline in general. Like that might have happened even if he wasn't their father.
No, totally. I was more like, I was more disappointed that Britney's kids would use gay slurs because I was like,
that's not fair.
Yeah, I was like, oh, are teenage boys still doing that? I thought maybe we had like moved into a slightly better era, but it just felt so like what preteen boys were like when I was a preteen. And I was like, oh,
the worst of it.
No. And then I was like, Kevin Federline must just like use it at home because that's where they would probably pick it up, or at school. Who knows?
He's probably using a lot of words at home.
It just made me be like, how does he talk about Britney to his kids if they're like, oh, my mom, you know, if that's how they think of her as like the moneymaker. Like, that just made me sad.
That is so sad because she is just such a sweet soul. I wanted to applaud you for, I don't know if it's a collaborative playlist, but I really loved seeing Unusual You on one of your latest Patreon playlists.
It is a collaborative playlist. We do mixes every month for Night Call. And the theme of this month that we're doing in April is plastic surgery. Wow. And so we're reading this manga that's really good called Helter Skelter. That's about like this model who gets all this plastic surgery to become perfect. And then it starts like basically rotting away. It's like a really good comic. Wow. So that was like the theme of the mix sort of.
That works.
Like, just sort of like eerie, uncanny pop music.
I feel Britney, obviously Blackout in 2007 is like her quintessential album in a way, or at least like the artistic like one we applaud. But I really, really love Circus as well.
Oh yeah, me too. I've been listening to Circus. A lot of Britney.
Me too, during this hard time.
Yeah, it provides comfort.
And phonography, baby. That's what was getting me up today to do this.
Yeah.
This really hard task.
I think also just like after going to The Zone, I was like, Britney has like so many hits and, and B-sides. Just comparing her to any pop star now, it's like, I don't think a pop star will ever achieve that level of sort of like monoculture ever again, you know? Like,
no.
Everybody I know is excited about Dua Lipa, but, like, does your average person know who Dua Lipa is at this point? Like, probably not in the way that, like, everybody knew who Britney was. Even if you didn't listen to her,
you're experiencing her.
Yeah.
Whether it's through the Pepsi commercial or TRL or MTV or the radio.
Yeah. I feel like Rihanna is the last pop star who's, and she's not just a pop star, but like Rihanna has that level of celebrity where she's like a one name Madonna, Britney,
Beyonce. Yeah, I think about it. I have a lot of cousins that I grew up with in LA, and one of them is like, Kayla, shouts out, I'm sure you'll listen.
Kayla.
21, 22, and I'm 28. So it's interesting, like for her, I remember Rihanna coming up, like, I already felt like I was old, but I was probably, like, sixth grade or something, but, like, for her, like, she grew up with Rihanna, like, her whole, like, when she was, like, really tiny, we would be singing Unfaithful together at Disneyland, like, she's just had her as a one-name person her whole life, where, like...
Right, and having that pop star who, like, you know, those eras mean so much to you when you're that age, especially. Yeah.
Because, like, even for Beyonce, I felt like I would, because my first concert was Destiny's Child, and it was actually amazing. At the, what is that place called? It's like a desert town. And it was at like a, basically the fair, like the end of summer kind of fair, not LA County, Antelope Valley Fair.
Oh, that's so funny.
Isn't that so funny? Because it's so, like, humble. It makes me feel right. Like I witnessed the movie Selena being filmed or something.
You sort of, you basically did.
Yeah, because, like, I only bring it up because I didn't, I wasn't introduced to Beyonce as a one-word name. You know, I kind of grew up with her still. Whereas my younger cousin, again, like, she would listen to Destiny's Child, but it was already, like, Beyonce era.
You were like, Beyonce of Destiny's Child of the Antelope Valley Fair.
Yeah, exactly. But being it's also, too scared to dance.
That makes you a good star, too, if you did really come up on, like, the state fair and mall circuit the way that Beyonce and Britney both did.
Because it's all the same. You can really perform.
Yeah, and it's, like, the same stuff over and over again. The stage just keeps getting bigger, you know? Yeah.
What about these people who go from, like, their bedroom... And then they're like, I mean, you know, it's just different, like the way that the like trajectory.
No, totally. You're right. Cause like Billie Eilish didn't have any kind of an interstitial time period. She didn't do any kind of like slow build, which I also feel like isn't probably healthy for like any musician, you know? And I feel like that's become more of an internet thing. Like the same thing with Lorde. It's like when they take people from like 0 to 1,000 like that, I'm sort of like, well, how are those people going to feel when there's like a drop, you know, like how do those people feel when like all the attention isn't on them all of a sudden after they've been told that like they're the most special person ever, you know?
That's when they're going to be like, they realize they're going to need to become craftsmen.
Yeah. Like, or like just songwriters, if you're smart, I think is like, you know, not just the idol provide the like, the backup, because I just think it's like it wears on you too, like how long can a person do stadium tours without sort of like losing their mind, you know?
Or like, I mean, I'm not saying like I hate these people, but just like we've been rocking with Katy Perry and Gaga for so long now, and like they both still feel extremely thirsty for this kind of attention, and it's like,
well, I also feel bad for them too in a way, because it is like, what do you do when then it like levels off in your 30s if you're like a pop star who like got famous in your 20s, and you're like, you know, you either have to go like the ray of light route, or you have to be like an actual songwriter. If you're just like the vessel, you know, I mean, I think Katy Perry is a songwriter, so I feel like she's okay, and Lady Gaga too, probably, but it does also seem like they're both people that don't just want to be in the background. Like,
no, they're just like debuting these like really extreme, but also the opposite of extreme looks out.
Okay,
at the same
I think it's a funny. Okay, so like you watch Vanderpump Rules, obviously.
Uh huh.
You know, it's like, you know how Stassi and Katie and them are like all trying to be like, now we're homemakers.
Yeah. They have a new identity.
That's what Katy Perry is going for. She's like, now I'm like, here's my slow transition back into Christian music, probably.
Right.
You know, like wedding songs and like pregnancy songs.
Music to put your kids to sleep.
Adult contemporary. And then Gaga is like Sheena. Gaga's like, no, I'm still young. I'm a
look how
star.
Hot I am.
I can fucking dance. Remember how much you liked me in A Star Is Born. Like
kink.
Yeah,
fetish.
And it also feels really desperate, but like in a different way. But I also completely understand, because like, what are you supposed to do? You know,
right?
Like, male musicians, I feel like get to just be like, oh, now they're in their 30s and they're like a mature artist. But like with pop stars, it's like they really do get pushed off the cliff sometimes. You know, which is why Britney is so beloved, because we have to save her from being pushed off the cliff.
Please, we'll all bow down as much as we need to make that happen.
But I thought it was funny. Some people were being shady about Gaga because they were like, she canceled. She like is reformulating her album now, because I think the first single was kind of a flop, Stupid Love.
Yeah.
So she's like back in the lab with Chromatica. She's like, oh, I'm going to delay the album release because it's not the right time. And everybody was like, oh, well, meanwhile, like Dua Lipa's leaking her album early because it leaked. Like she's putting it out early. Like clearly there is a thirst for pop music in this period. That just like wasn't what people wanted. But then I'm also like, is it just like Dua Lipa's 22 and she's like the new thing? And Gaga is like on album 5 or 6 or whatever.
Right. We're just like not. Yeah, I think, I don't know. I feel like, I haven't listened to the new Dua Lipa album.
It's really good. You should listen to it. You'll like it a lot.
I'll like it because her songs are just like that pop, you know, that vibe we all want.
It's very like 2000s throwback in the sense that it's like just pure Europop. It's like a Kylie Minogue album. It's like not EDM at all or dubstep or anything. It's like just moving away from that back to like
something you can wear chiffon and dance to.
Totally. And it's very good. It's very like springy. It is like, but it is interesting because you're like, does that just happen when you're like starting out that you are more in tune with whatever the new thing are? And then when you're like, whatever the new thing is. And then when you're on like album, whatever, you're like just overthinking it so much of like, what's going to be popular? What are people going to like?
Right. And you're just so worried about that youth. Like you're just feeling like pressure that like you're alienated from that youth spirit, even if you might, you know, not like they could possibly not even be, but they just make choices that are because they're so worried about it all.
Right. And like Madonna did an amazing job up to like just a certain point. Like she went way further than anyone else did, and again, obviously I think Rihanna will just have a long career for the same reason, but now Madonna is like in this very like desperate, you know, trying to be on the pulse but like so insulated from what's cool that like, because like my boyfriend's always saying like if Madonna just made like a Detroit techno album, she was like, I'm not from New York, I'm from Michigan, you know, and just like worked with like Detroit legends or something, just like there are things she could do still that would make good music. That's just like, I just feel like she doesn't have anyone around her that doesn't say yes to her, you know.
Yeah,
she's been so famous for so long,
right?
And so if someone's like, make a Diplo album, she's like, okay,
Diplo's hot, like
but like it's not just that she's like of a certain age and like wants to be hot and wants to be, you know, cool still. It's that she gives off this desperate energy. Cause I was like, who isn't like that? I was like, oh, Grace Jones, like Grace Jones.
Opposite of thirsty.
Opposite.
Energy.
Right. Like quenched. Nobody ever would be like, oh, Grace Jones is like too old to be hot. Cause she's like so fucking hot.
And she exactly,
you know, but she doesn't give off that neediness.
Desperation.
She doesn't, she just seems self-contained and self-sufficient, which is like what you really want in a female pop star. Although with Britney, it's the vulnerability that makes her so lovable.
But the sexual confidence is authentically Britney. Do you know what
I mean? Totally.
How she's vulnerable, but like she's so hot and like
she has
it's
physical. She has like body confidence that comes from a place of athleticism, which is like what makes it so attractive.
And that like down homeness is still her like aura is so grounded.
Her aura is Louisiana through and through.
Yes. I love it.
Me too. Even her like eyeliner that everyone's so mean about, where they're like, why does she do the raccoon eyes? I'm like, because she's a Southern woman.
Yeah,
that
like
the look.
She looks like she's on the Bravo South shows.
Right. And like if you look at pictures of her mom when, you know, with young baby Britney, it's like her mom did the raccoon eye always. So I'm just like, it's just
you're
her,
right about that.
What she thinks like an adult woman does, you know?
I still have a life dream of seeing Britney at the Commons in Calabasas. Like in the old days, I thought it was going to be at, like, Cold Stone Creamery, but now I think it's going to be at, like, Sun Life Organics. I hope it comes true.
There was one time when she was when she was still driving, when she went to the Betsy Johnson store in Fashion Square.
Mm-hmm.
It was, like, in Us Weekly. It was
Rest
like
in
Spears.
Peace, that store.
Yeah, right? I was like, Britney Spears took over the Betsy Johnson store in Fashion Square and tried on everything in the store. And I was like, oh my God, what if I'd been there?
Literally, you're like, that was right down the freaking corner from Coffee Bean. I could have had the full show.
Been in that Betsy Johnson store a million times and never bought anything because I can't afford it. But Britney, right. Britney can.
I felt that way about, like, I probably couldn't have afforded it, but my parents are, like, not smart spenders, so I probably could have got something from there. But there probably was a thing that was, like, sized appropriately, but I still, like, needed to go in every time to just experience the patterns.
No, totally.
Do you think Fashion Square is the most iconic mall in LA? Or at least in the Valley, I mean.
I mean, now it is. Now that the Galleria is no longer with us, I would say. The Sherman Oaks Gallery, obviously the Glendale Galleria, we still have. I will say, I read, one of the things I read about Eve Babbitts said that she loved to go to the Glendale Galleria to clear her mind. I was
Thank
like,
you so much for sharing so that.
So relatable.
It's insanely relatable. That's so funny. I wish that, well, I'll share another life dream of mine. I have very humble goals, is to have an office above, like, at the Sherman Oaks Galleria that still exists as, like, not a proper mall, but the Arclight and stuff. There's so many office buildings there, and have, like, production offices there. And I'm like, what if the 420 talent film production office is at the Sherman Oaks Gallery? I'll be so happy.
Oh, my God. I have an even better idea. You should take over the old Vivid building.
Oh, in Studio City? Yeah.
Yeah.
Every time we pass, my boyfriend's like, I miss Vivid building.
Me too. Every time I see it, I'm like, it doesn't say Vivid anymore, but it's still the Vivid building to me forever.
I used to work, I worked for like a documentary that was made like in the production office, like maybe five storefronts down or something. And I would just like go walk by, go buy weed, go smoke in front of the Vivid building. And I feel like I interviewed the creator of Vivid a couple times, and like, he was never wanting, I always was wanting to be like more pally about, not as friends, but just about the info. You know, I wanted to like gossip more, and he was always kind of being like, it was a long time ago now, you know?
Like, I need more. I love talking to 90s porn people.
They are
all like that. They're like, it was, they get a little like wistful because they're just like, it was an amazing time and now it's gone.
It was another era, babe.
Yeah.
That's the part about Joe Exotic, too, that I wanted to mention, is that, like, it kind of made me think about what I love about being a journalist, which is just the wide range of experts that I encountered.
Yeah, and you and I both, I feel like, it's like, we love talking to somebody who knows everything about something.
And that doesn't mean that they know everything about everything. And it's like, because I've had that experience before where like I'll have a really, really compelling and a really, really specific interview with someone, and then we'll like connect on social media, or they'll write, you know, somehow I'm like involved in their life beyond that convo. And then like I'll see something where I'm like, oh, that's random, that doctor is a Republican, or not to be so stigmatizing to, but you know, just like, or worse, honestly, like, or seeing like some, like, I did a story about like fathers from the 80s and 90s living with HIV, who at the time of their diagnosis thought that they weren't going to ever experience their kid's life. And then like, they've experienced it, and it's really amazing. But then like, when I see what that guy, who's like a total weirdo and specific person with a complicated ass life, when I see what they're just like posting on their own, I'm like, ooh, yuck, like, ew.
No,
like,
totally. I mean, that also happens where you're like, oh, am I, like, shaping this person to seem like the person that I know, like, we want them to seem like? Because that's what, like, a story will do. And definitely, like, I've thought about this, you know, because, like, I've definitely interviewed some people who then got canceled later, you know, where you were like, ooh, like, am I naive because I like didn't pick up on any dark energy when I interviewed this person because they were being nice to me and sucking up because I'm a journalist?
Right. I mean, yeah, like, or even I'm just being honest because whatever, like when I interviewed Jeff Goldblum at the beginning of when did I do it? I guess it was over the summer, like summer 2019 sometime. Like, I just was assigned the story for like a cult VIP feature, which is just means like we're writing about someone that's like iconic, you know, it's not necessarily of this era, it's someone or of all the eras, whatever. And like, I don't know. I knew that some people are like, basically what I knew then is still what exists, which is like one day people are going to come out about Jeff Goldblum, right? But like that day hadn't come, you know, like I didn't.
I also think that that is not necessarily true about Jeff Goldblum. I'm just going to say I also interviewed Jeff Goldblum and I think a lot of people have interviewed him. I think there's a difference, which is that he's just really flirtatious. Right. And we are in an era now where people are like, oh, like, do we police flirting? But that's like, but that's also like, I don't think anyone is trying to police flirting. Like, that's what people who are like mad about cancel culture always say. They're like, oh, what, we can't flirt anymore? And it's like, no, of course, like, people are going to flirt and like, you know, flirt at work still anyway. It's just like, I think it depends on like whether you're vibing with it. Like I personally was like, I'm a journalist. I'm here to do the Jeff Goldblum interview. Everybody knows what you get with that is that he's like a flirty person. He's going to flirt with you because he's an actor. But you also know that he's like doing it as a performance because you're a journalist and he's an actor.
Right.
You
know? And I'm going into it being like, I'm a journalist who's a wannabe actor who's a flirt. Like,
right, that's the
so
thing.
I think it's like if gonna have fun, you know,
if everyone's consenting then it's right. Fine, then it's yeah. Actually like cool. And also like I don't know, I was accidentally an hour late to interview him also because I had, it was like daylight savings time or something, and then mm-hmm. He was like, I was so worried he was gonna be like a dick, you know, and be like,
yeah, for sure.
And he was just very nice and friendly about it. And yeah, and we ended up talking about, because it was like right after the shooting in Pittsburgh. He's like a Jew from Pittsburgh,
yeah,
and we like ended up talking about that. I mean, he definitely, like, you know, I'm not like I. That's the thing with any celebrity though, is you're just like, I don't really know this person. I know them as a public figure, and I'm like basing my understanding of how to interact with them on that. But like, they might be totally different in their private life. But that's like not your job. It's not, you're not being an investigative journalist in that case to like
no.
Dig up dirt. But I do think, just to bring it back to Scott Peterson, it's like, yeah, just because somebody is cheating on their wife doesn't make them a murderer. Just because
right.
Somebody is like a flirtatious person doesn't make them a sexual assaulter.
Right.
You know, not every womanizer is like an actual rapist. Some people are just womanizers, and like maybe that's like can be emotionally abusive. But again, I'm like, I just feel like Jeff Goldblum dated a bunch of like hotties and now he's like married to an aerialist.
Yeah, I was gonna tell you, my friend from high school, Katrina Kemp, she is a performer. Like, she'll do a lot of stage shows. Like, she's an actor and does comedy, but is also like very good at dancing and stage work like that. Like, not aerialism per se, but different kinds of troupes like that. And she told me that she went on tour with his girl, with his wife, before they were together, and that then like a Cirque du Soleil tour, and then that she met Jeff Goldblum while at Equinox on Sunset. And I just thought that was such a funny meeting place
that
for
is
them.
Funny. Totally. And perfect. And yeah,
yeah.
And there's also just like a Puritanism in our culture, especially of like, you know, married people shouldn't flirt, which is like totally ridiculous. Cause like, of course married people can flirt, you know, again, it doesn't mean you're going to like follow through. It's just like a lot of interaction and friendship is like flirtatious. And it would be weird if people were like, I'm going to make sure I never say anything funny or cute, you know?
Well, people who are like that are miserable.
No, I mean, totally.
It's just not sustainable, like, to be able to really, like, qualify and distinguish, like, what's flirting versus not is pretty hard to do.
I think it's also hard for, like, you know, let's say these are, like, incels or whatever who are mad about this, who are like, well, it doesn't work like that for me. I mean, that's a thing, too, is it's like, again, it has to be consensual. Like, if you're hitting on somebody or flirting with them and they're not picking it up, or they're actively, like, you know, stonewalling you, you have to, like, know how to pick up on that vibe and change directions, you know? Like,
literally. You can't take,
yeah, like, some people are just flirty with everybody, especially actors and famous people are all like that.
Which, that part is, like, so creepy, though, sometimes.
I mean, well, for sure, because you're
not
also
creepy in a way that I'm fearful for safety. It's just, like, a weird vibe.
It's a weird, well, because you're doing, like, this weird dance. It's, like, interviewing a celebrity is such a specific thing that we both do, and it's, like, you have to, you know, it's like a blind date.
Yeah.
You know, and
that,
and
you've researched before, just like, right, people would.
Yeah. And it's like a weird first date with somebody where you're like, I know all this stuff about them, but what will they be like in real life? You know, and like, your classic celebrity profile is just sort of like, isn't this person great? They're my new best friend. Wouldn't you love for them to be your new best friend?
They're literally it right now. They're, yeah, of the moment. Like, it's just always about how, like, this is their time.
And so, yeah, like, doing a good job with that is its own skill. But, yeah, definitely I often am like, what are the ethics of, like, you know, if this person turns out to be a bad person, like, am I in some way culpable for making them seem like your cool best friend?
Right.
But I also think, like, you can't know going in.
What did it feel like, like, when you were reading the different pieces by Eve Babbitts that are included in I Used to Be Charming, and they're from Esquire and Playboy and all these different magazines, and some of them are, like, I love her Nicolas Cage profile.
Oh, my God,
for example.
Yeah.
But, like, when you read that generation of, like, specifically her, but, like, magazine writing from a different generation, including celebrity profiling, like, does it feel different than what we get to do today or something?
I mean, in some ways, like, on the one hand, I'm like, oh my God, there were so many magazines.
Right.
That's the real thing. I'm just like, oh, I didn't even know, like, that, you know, she wrote so much for outlets, you know, and
yeah,
some of the stuff that she did, like, for money, where I'm just like, oh yeah, like, I do stuff like that.
West Waves.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, where it's like, you know, a weird one-off magazine, but, like, you're trying to find whatever is fun and interesting about that for you. Like, I just wrote something for, like, a cruise ship magazine. Funny timing.
Cool.
But,
yeah.
You know, yeah, I was like, sure. Like,
but
why
it,
not?
Like, it goes, yeah, like, there's room for it. Or it makes,
yeah,
like, everything you read from her, even though there's so many different publications, it all makes sense for, like, her voice.
Yeah, it's all, like, something that she finds really interesting, and she makes you interested in it, too, which is, like, the greatness of her. I do think the main thing that has changed, and I think this is just also specific to her, is, like, the access that she got and that some of those writers got.
Right.
You know, where you could write about things more critically, like in the Godfather piece, you know. She's very, like, playfully critical of Coppola as a person and of Zoetrope as a company in a way that's, like, very arch, but also insidery, you know?
Right.
It's like she likes it, and she's going to all the parties and hanging out, but she's also, like, you know, a little suspicious of people building somebody up to be the great man in the way that they are with Francis Coppola at that time, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, the movies are good, but they come together sort of haphazardly, and then everyone, like, declares that it was this masterpiece that was, like, you know, sent from God.
Right,
just sort
or,
of
like,
showing,
dangerously.
Yeah, like, showing the seams. And talking about, like, I love the part where she talks about going to the party for The Great Gatsby and being, like, the movie was, like, a bomb, but the party was amazing and the food,
yeah,
was really good. Because,
yeah,
that's also just, yeah, just the idea that, like, if you spend the most money on something, it'll be the best is very Great Gatsby, the movie, and also the book, you know?
Totally.
So, yeah, I think she does deconstruct sort of the notion of celebrity in a way that is super, super well done. But
well,
I don't know.
I feel like she also is just so self-assured that when she shows up for an interview, like, I don't know. I sometimes think that this is not like a blanket statement because there's so many amazing journalists and entertainment journalists. But like, there is something about the culture of entertainment journalism today, I think, where like the expectation is that you're kind of going to be a fangirl from the beginning, or like,
yes, totally.
You're
if you're not
be exalting and worshiping these people. Right.
Right. And that's like, that's also because celebrities now are just, you know, and I think this was always true. There was always an issue of access of like, if you write something critical about somebody, like they'll pull access, you know, which
yeah.
is like what magazines really care about. So I think the fact that she was doing the Godfather thing for like a Zoetrope magazine, it was like on the budget of the thing she was writing about, and they were all friends enough with her to be like, yeah, do whatever you want. So mm-hmm. I don't think it like isn't possible. I just think you would need somebody with balls to
right.
publish it, which I don't know that
exists. Maybe one day in the new world.
Maybe.
Like when you sat down to write your introduction, was that like the culmination of a lot of like research and thinking or wondering or like
definitely,
were you
definitely a lot of thinking? I feel like I'm one of those people who just like writes something in my head for like days, you know,
right.
and then like puts it on the page at the end. But I'm definitely like, the time that I think of as procrastinating is often actually like I am
when you're doing it.
Right, like I am working on it in my head. I'm just also like driving around and, you know,
yeah,
looking at Twitter in between or whatever.
Totally, but just sitting.
I was definitely like intimidated to do it, you know, just because I'm such a fan and I didn't want to do it in a way that was like just aping her, you know?
Yeah.
Because when I read her for the first time, I was like, oh, where was this person my whole life? But also sort of like, oh, if I had discovered her earlier, I would have just imitated her. And in a way,
yeah.
like, good, I didn't, because I would have just
That's
been like,
real.
Oh, well, someone did the thing that I wanted to do already, so, like, now I don't
yeah.
have to do it. But
yeah.
I wrote one that, I wrote, like, a first draft that I ended up, like, discarding, and then I wrote it again. Yeah, and just, I don't know, I like the way it turned out. And
it's beautiful. I love it.
Thank you. But yeah, I, you know, as an Angeleno, obviously, I just feel like she writes about LA so well. And in the same way that like Jonathan Gold does, where it's just like the perspective of a native, not somebody coming at it from, you know, what is this weird fucked up place, you know, that I, a New Yorker, am discovering, but just like, no, it's a real city. It's full of immigrants. It's not just all rich white people in mansions, but there's also that too, you know?
It's not all about your own aspiration and how it reflects back to you based on its fulfillment or not. Like,
right, totally. Because like all the LA books are written by like East Coast transplants who came here to like, you know, try and make it big and
yeah.
and you know, drink themselves to death. So that
yeah.
is the still, even the perspective you see on LA is like, oh, it's this terrible place and everyone's stupid and superficial. But there's also like a freedom in that that I think a lot of West Coast artists have, which is like there aren't these traditions that you're supposed to be working in. So you can just start from your own place that's completely yours and doesn't have to do with that. And
right.
I think Eve Babbitts is like
so good at that.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah, because she's like, yeah, it's amazing to be like, when you don't quite fit in, you get to do your own thing.
Yeah, and one thing I read was that she sort of wrote her first book, Eve's Hollywood, in response to, she was friends with Joan Didion, and Joan Didion had put out the White Album, and that Eve Babbitts was like, well, like, this is a view of Los Angeles, but also it's not all doom and gloom and, you know, disaster. Doomsday stuff.
They're like, you're just depressed, babe. Fuck.
Well, I like how she also, in one of the books, they like get her to talk in Hollywood's Eve, the bio by Lillian
uh-huh.
Malick. They at one point, Lily's like, gets her to talk a little shit about Joan Didion, where she's like, oh, well, Joan Didion was a speed freak.
Yeah, yeah.
Which totally tracks, you know? Like, yeah. And also she says something which I also say, which is like, well, Joan Didion's from Sacramento. Like, she's not
This from big Los New Angeles. She's Lady Bird.
Yeah, she is Lady Bird. Totally. And like, being from Sacramento too, it's like, it's just, it's still California, but it is different from Los Angeles. Like, she came from a very sort of she came from a sort of like Republican pioneer upbringing, and that's like the perspective that she brought to the 60s, obviously, you know, was sort of like a cynicism, and Eve Babbage just approaches it from a completely different place, which is like sort of an optimism tempered by expectation, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like, well, like, you already know. I mean, it's like, what am I interested in? It's like similar to you, where it's like, thank God I didn't read Eve Babbage as like a high schooler too, because it would just have been like just too much. I don't know. I would have been like too like overwhelmed, I think, by like
too enthralled. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do feel like something else that I think a lot of like Angelinos think about, and especially like, you know, I live in the house. I'm in the house. My, you know, my family has lived in the Valley since like 1955 or something. So it's just like, I'm really interested in like history and memory of different places here. And like, so much of the time, public art and the preservation of like certain history in LA is diminished. And like, reading Eve is always this portal into these like places or storefronts or restaurants or hotels that a lot of them don't exist, but like,
totally. Her. Yeah, it recreates this landscape of this LA that doesn't exist anymore, you know, but it's also sort of timeless about the way she writes about the landscape. It's like, oh, yeah, there's like these little ticky tack neighborhoods, and then there's like these big, stupid developments by Mar Vista.
Weird there.
Yeah, like, it still feels very, very timely.
Definitely. And did you ever idolize Joan Didion?
You know, no, I didn't. Like, I like Joan Didion. I like respect Joan Didion, but I think I also just very quickly caught on that there were like only two female authors that like men respect, and that they are Joan Didion and Susan Sontag, you know,
right?
Where they're like, okay, I got one, I'm good. And just that, like, any good female writer gets compared to Joan Didion, because you're like, you can compare female writers.
Because you're good.
Right. And it's like, you can compare female writers to male writers also, you know. Right. But yeah, it's just like, she's good at what she does. Like Eve says, it's like, you know, she's good at what she does, but it does also like get me up in arms sometimes about just sort of the portrayal of LA as like a decadent, rotting paradise, you know.
Yeah.
Which, again, it also is. It's not that, but, you know, Eve is more like, you know, Eve comes from such a different world than Joan Didion. She's like the child of like bohemian leftists in Hollywood. Yeah. And that just, to me,
is more
of Los Angeles. Yeah.
Yeah, that I'm familiar of course. With.
And of just course, sort of that course. Stuff about, yeah, like I grew up in Hollywood for like the first 5 years of my life before we moved to the Valley. And I definitely have that same thing of just like, okay, well, like, you know, Hollywood is like a real place in addition to like a cultural idea. And it's like an interesting real place and an interesting cultural idea.
And then I love it both.
Yeah. And then I moved to North Hollywood, which is like
nice
abstract, you know,
right?
Not anywhere near Hollywood, just using the name, but
also shared territory with Susan Sontag.
True. Yeah, that's right. And I think Marilyn Monroe lived in North Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like they both went to North Hollywood High, I think.
Yeah. Right, so like Valley Girl intelligentsia has always been
hello.
A thing.
It's like us, just kidding.
Right, and like, well, Susan Sontag and Didion too. It's like you could sense that they were trying to like become a New York writer, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They wanted to become part of the East Coast establishment, and they did. They were super successful at that. But like Eve Babbage was just like doing her own thing. she could give a fuck about the East Coast establishment.
Right.
She like dabbles in it, but gets stressed out by it. And like, that has totally been my experience, you know,
mm-hmm.
of just like, I try and sometimes, and then I'm always like, oh, this is so like uptight. I can't handle it. Like nobody gives a fuck about me here. Like,
it makes me feel so suburban.
It makes me feel so like just a cowgirl.
I'm not someone who really like, I love a snack, but I'm not someone who really wants to like eat while I read. But something about Eve Babbitt's books, just like, I think it's a compliment to her writing that it makes me feel like you want to like curl up with like a morsel and like, just like the prioritization of like pleasure, and it's just like orgasm and sees candy and palm trees.
Right. Well, I think that's also what differentiates. I mean, that is my suspicion, is like that men read Joan Didion and Susan Sontag and consider them intellectual peers because like they don't write about female pleasure really in the same. I mean, maybe Sontag a little bit, but like
a lot of displeasure. Yeah.
Yeah. They like, Eve is just so focused on female pleasure, and also, yeah, just because she's so freed from the expectation of being a serious writer, she can write about, like, having big boobs. Like,
that's a good essay. I like it.
Right, it's a great essay, and there's a great Nora Ephron essay that I don't know if they were in conversation with each other. I think I just assumed they were, because Nora Ephron wrote one that was like, I have small boobs, and it's like, the Nora Ephron essay was really funny because it's like self-deprecating in the opposite way, where she was like, I was the only secretary that John Kennedy never hit on. You know? And at the end of the essay, she's like, I suspect that if I had breasts, like my whole life would be different.
Yeah.
So I just love both of those essays, because I do think that it's just like the grass is always greener on the other side, you know? And Eve sort of is just like, no, having big boobs is amazing. But it's like, there's obviously also a downside to being sexualized all the time.
Right. Like, I was thinking about just about how we all like treat ourselves in response to like what we are or have or perceive to have. Like, and just thinking about people who, like, especially women, young women with, or all ages, but especially like young women with like huge boobs or like very voluptuous. Those are a lot of the time, those are who you see the most in like streetwear and boxy clothes, because they can't take it, right?
Right,
like,
they don't want to be. That's what I like about Billie Eilish, is that she's like that. She's like, I didn't want anyone to see my body, so like I wore big clothes, which I think is like a super common thing for girls with like a lot of body types. But yeah, especially girls who like develop super early. But there is like this construction set up where you're supposed to like, where people are just like envious of each other for things. And it doesn't have to be like that. I was did you develop early?
I mean, for me, I felt like always having just like a larger body, that I was more of like, I had to hide my body because that was all that there was. But then it was more like, my response was the exact opposite to, I think, the kind of imagery I was drawing, which is like, I'm not going to be sexualized enough, so let me make sure that I'm showing off everything I can to like stay in the mix.
Yeah, I feel like I was like super kid looking, you know. I was like, I didn't develop until late. Even though I like got my period, I was still just like super flat chested.
Yeah.
Like all through high school. And I was super jealous of girls who had big boobs. And then like later I got like a little extra puberty at the end and I got more boobs. And then I was like, oh, now I understand like why this would also be stressful. It's like,
right.
It was just all things I had never thought about, you know, where I was like, oh, it would be nice to get that attention. And then it's like, oh no, if you get attention for like your body, it's like not for you in the same way. It's just different.
And you can't turn it off.
Right. And you can't turn it off. And Eve Babbitt is just like, writes about that in a way that's really interesting, where she's like, yeah, she writes about like, you want the attention, but also like you recognize that it makes people write you off as like a party girl.
Totally.
Men. It makes men do that.
Yeah.
Because they're stupid.
But women do. I mean, I feel like through a lot of my sexiest friends is how, which is like obviously subjective, but just saying like sex workers and people who are just like stylistically like serving tons of body and tons of sex, like the response from women that I've received while with them, you know, is like so insane too.
That's true. I think people, there is just like a Puritan thing in America that does just make people like uncomfortable about sex, you know, even in Los Angeles, where I think it's probably the most normalized of anywhere in America.
Right.
Know? Los but Angeles like, and Miami, I feel like we're
No wonder I love it there so much.
I think Miami, I've said this before, but I think Florida is California's California.
It's like God, so real.
Like, I love Florida, and I just feel like it's the place that we are all like, that's where everyone's like in a bikini all the time, the way that people think we are
and
here.
And just like with like whiffs of coconut oil and orange blossom and like.
Yeah, just like pleasure, like sensual pleasure. And the same thing where people are like, oh, well, if a place is so sensually pleasurable, it can't also be
real.
Smart, you know, or real.
Yeah.
And it's like. No, it's both. It's both. And that's
and it's actually, if we're going to still be hierarchical, it's actually smarter because it's all of it. You know what I mean? It can be embodied and, like, I hate intellectualism that's, like, stripped from your body or, like, alienated. And I feel like sometimes that, like, uppers and, like, rail thin upper writing is just, like, feels different.
No, totally.
It feels cold because your body's cold, babe.
And it's interesting because, like, Eve, you know, I think is also portraying herself in her writing as sort of, like, an idealized, hot version of herself that, you know, is the way that writers have their own sort of personas that you work into your writing.
Totally.
And, you know, some of the stuff I've read from, like, other men talking about her in the period, like, people would, like, call her fat and be, like,
totally,
she, you know, and weird looking, and just to hear men be like just sort of just dismissive of her. I read a book by a guy, the art gallerist, that was like the guy that she was dating when she did playing chess with Duchamp, and she was trying to get back at because he was her boyfriend and he was married, so she was like trying to like show him up. And he had a book, like an autobiography, and I like looked her up in the back, and there's literally like one mention of her in passing where he was like, my girlfriend at the time, Eve Babbitts, like did this thing.
Wow.
Where I was just like, right, because that's what she, I was like, oh, if you're like writing, you're writing to just like establish that you exist, you know, to be like, all these men are creating these narratives of the counterculture, and you're also creating just the totally, just all these iconic things, but like not ever being egotistical about it, you know, like she fucking did the Buffalo Springfield cover collage.
Right. I feel like I relate to this idea of like, she's never quite sure if she has a career or not, even though she's always doing chill things that
she's
happy to be doing.
Yeah, for sure. That is the freelance lifestyle to a T.
I liked it. I listened to, I think, your Summer House pod, and you're like, you know, this is kind of my lifestyle, you know, because I'm a freelancer, and maybe you work from home or work in your own community, and, like, you're used to, like, having to, like, kind of live your day based on your own choices and, like, scheduling and all that, or lack thereof, and, like...
Yeah, we already make our own schedules and wear soft pants.
Literally, but I like how you say, I didn't necessarily want everyone else to, like, how you were like, I kind of was down to go do a job I loved. Like,
no, I've been thinking about that a lot, because I was like, yeah, like, my fantasy was not to, like, drag everyone down to my level.
Uh-huh.
But I do feel like from this place I can offer some help, maybe, of, like, what to do when you have to make your own schedule and wear soft pants all the time.
Right, you gotta wash them, get all... I'm wearing tie-dye soft pants right now. They're not yogic at all. They're more festival. I would say they're festival wear.
I'm wearing a pajama set from Forever 21, two mismatched ones, and the top is a shirt that says Spring Vibes.
Yes, you're on trend, spring baby.
It's my spring break.
Okay, I know I talked to you for so long, but can I just ask you a couple questions kind of quickly and then we'll wrap up?
Yeah, of course, for sure.
Can you tell me quickly about your experience, like the literal scene setting of you interviewing Lana Del Rey?
Oh, sure. I tweeted that I wanted to interview Lana Del Rey. I was like putting it into the universe that I want to interview Lana Del Rey this year. And Craig Marks from the LA Times wrote me an email and was like, hey, we're supposed to interview Lana Del Rey. Do you want to do it? And I was like, oh my God, yay, of course. But then it was sort of like, I wasn't sure if it was going to happen, you know, like when you're trying to schedule an interview and it's just kind of like,
yeah,
you know, you're like waiting for the time and date and you're the whole time. You're like, I shouldn't even tell people it's happening in case it doesn't happen.
Right.
But yeah, it was in Laurel Canyon at a house they had rented, I think, for the photo shoot. That was like an amazing A-frame cabin. And it was great. I was super nervous for all the reasons we talked about above, about,
yeah,
you know, especially interviewing somebody whose work you really admire, where you're like,
it's like worse. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, what if we don't get along?
Right.
But yeah, I like loved her. She was really funny and cool and sweet. My friend Megan Garvey had interviewed her and she had been like, she's really sweet. It's like, you know, that's the thing I would say to describe her. And I was like, that is exactly right. Sort of like Britney in that way, where you're just like, there's like a core sweetness to this person that
sweetie pie
makes you love them. Yeah. And sort of that Maryland thing, too. You're just like, I love you. I want to take care of you. Yeah, she offered me some kombucha. There were like,
yes,
some hot guys playing music on the porch when I got there. This is the like 60s music journalism experience. And then after that, I was kind of like, you know, because music journalism, I've sort of been doing it on and off, but like less recently. And yeah. I was very like satisfied after that. I was like, I can retire from music journalism.
Yeah. You're like, you know what? I can rock.
Yeah. I told her to listen to Night Call at the end.
Aww.
And she was really nice about it. Yeah. She was nice like before and after we started talking too. You know, she wasn't like, she didn't have handlers.
Weirdo. Yeah.
She just seemed like she's like a real person, you know?
Oh, when you get that, it's always the best. I feel like, yeah, Norman fucking Rockwell. I mean, I already listened to it, obviously, when it came out. But since being in my house for 3 weeks, I've listened to it more than ever.
Every girl I know in quarantine has been listening to Lana. Lana and
oh,
Brittany,
my God. Something
keeping us.
Both sides of the spectrum. One, I need to go down. One, I need to get up. And so I know that we spoke a little bit in the past about Nolympic stuff, but as we wrap up here, I don't want to like not talk about something that I think is super interesting, which is like your own kind of organizing and amplification of critiques and information about,
sure,
the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, I started getting into organizing, like my boyfriend started getting into it a little bit earlier than me, and then he kind of brought me in. It was like right after I got laid off from MTV, you know, it was like I felt very lost. I was like, what am I doing with my life? Like, maybe music journalism isn't like a profession,
yeah,
necessarily that I want, you know, like I want to write film and TV. Like, why am I not just doing that? But I was feeling very lost, and getting into organizing provided just like a structure and sort of like a way to get out of myself that was so useful for me, but also it just like felt good to like be trying to help other people, you know? Like, one of the first things that we did was we're organizing, they're trying to get a neighborhood council for Skid Row, and just to like be around people that, you know, are so vulnerable and that the city is so awful to, and that they're all just, you know, like trying to get by and like still having like a lot of joy and, you know, optimism in a way that, like, you know, I think people don't always see. And right. Yeah, it just made me be like, who cares about my fucking stupid career? Like,
right.
You know, people have real problems and I want to be part of that too. So all the No Olympic stuff comes out of housing justice stuff, you know, which kind of just ties into all the, you know, the housing activism. But yeah, basically we're like, hey, like LA can't be throwing a big party for itself and for oligarchs in the city when it can't deal with like the thousands of people that can't afford to live anywhere in the city anymore.
Right.
You know, and just their policy for the last decade forever, I guess, has just been, you know, to sweep people and to put them in jail. And clearly that isn't working for anyone. You know, mm-hmm. the only actual solution is to house people. So yeah, you know, when they started doing the Olympic bid, we were just like, well, this is an insane thing for city council to pass, and just sort of drawing attention to like how much power city council has in LA and sort of how out of tune with the needs of LA all of those people are. They're all
right
landlords. They all, you know, they just all voted against like an eviction moratorium. You know, they're defending the needs of property owners, and like most people in LA are renters.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's just like a lot of stuff. Like LA is a very extreme place always, and the way it's been laid out is very segregated purposely, and there's a lot of class issues obviously, and housing is the way that a lot of it manifests. So yeah, and then we started talking to people in other cities that had either had or successfully gotten rid of the Olympics, because it just causes gentrification everywhere it goes. It causes environmental catastrophe. So we talked to people from Rio. Some of the No Olympics people went to Tokyo last summer to meet with the comrades there who, there were people who had been like pushed out of a building for the 60s Tokyo Olympics, and then mm-hmm. were being pushed out of another building for the 2020 Olympics.
Wow.
From the building they had been relocated into. So yeah, they just called off the Tokyo Olympics for this year because of COVID. But
yeah,
it's just the whole thing is like about, you know, people over profit, and it just seems clear, like this crisis has made it even more clear that like our system isn't working, a system that privileges profit at all costs and expects people to be just like working and making money 24 hours a day every day, and like can't function when that's not happening.
Right.
Like that obviously isn't working. But yeah, also my grandmother was a German Jewish athlete who was supposed to compete in the 1936 Olympics for Germany. And then Hitler came into power, and she was like kept on the team for a long time because they weren't sure if the world was going to boycott if they did just sort of openly talk about being eugenicists. Mm-hmm. And ultimately Hitler just got like cocky enough to be like, fuck it, and cut my grandmother from the team and said she wasn't a good enough athlete, which was not the real problem.
Mm-hmm.
But she was able to escape, you know, to England and then America because of it. So I've just always been thinking about, her name is Gretel Bergman. She's super cool.
So cool.
Yeah, no longer with us, but like a very inspiring person in my life always. Yeah, I think I've always just been interested in like issues of like fascism, media, how those things work together, you know?
Right, because... Well, yeah, for one, I love the piece you wrote in The New Yorker, I believe, about your grandmother and the Olympics. And I'm definitely ready to see the film version one day by you too, I hope. But
there's a German movie, actually. I haven't seen it, but there's
about it?
Yeah.
That's cool. But I also feel like... when you bring up like fascism in media, it's like the Olympics is something that like, even for people who aren't particularly patriotic or like, I, for example, didn't grow up in, like, a super patriotic, per se, household or, like, super into U.S. nationalism, even though my parents are both from here. But at the same time, the Olympics were a huge, huge thing. And so, like, I feel like just expanding the narrative around how we talk about the Olympics is really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, one thing we talk about in the Olympics a lot is that the 84 games, which, like, turned a profit because of sort of extraordinary circumstances where they got bailed out by McDonald's, but you know, the city of LA is always like, oh, they were good, they turned a profit, so it was great. But they also, you know, that was when they started doing gang sweeps and doing just sort of like, you know, random arrests of Black and brown youth in LA. It was when a lot of displacement happened. You know, they locked up all the homeless people for the 84 Olympics.
Wow. And
yeah, we just keep saying, like, there's no reason to think that they won't just do that again, you know?
Right. And
they have even admitted to some extent that, like,
that's the plan. Know.
Yeah, and we believe that a lot of, you know, this was when a lot of the really militarized policing in LA started, that, you know, then really accelerated with Police Chief Daryl Gates, and, you know, that we really believe was part of the what led to the 92 uprising.
Right. It was like setting the stage through the increased militarism.
Right. It was like, you're like, you know, yeah, you're harassing people just, you know, illegally. Like,
right.
Even beyond the bounds of like how the police normally harass people. But it also, yeah, normalized the type of harassment that is now just completely commonplace, that something like the Olympics, you know, just makes worse, because it also... Right. makes it a national special security event, which means like ICE comes in and gets free reign.
Yeah, we don't want that in LA.
We don't want that.
That was Tierney Talks to Molly Lambert. Thank you, Molly, for being on the show. If you're not already, please follow her at Molly Lambert on Twitter and on Instagram. Read her work in The New Yorker. Consider picking up the Eve Babbitts collection. And if you enjoyed this episode, please send it over to a friend. We're not shy over here. We're trying to build an audience. We want to amplify our engagement. We want listeners. We want to provide you with that little ASMR tickle in your ear as you socially distance. And when I say we, I mean me and Margot Padilla, the excellent audio producer and engineer who makes this happen. So until next time, I'm about to light this joint and think about who I want to talk to next.